Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When you think of the world's most dangerous places, does Congo make your list? More than 5 million people have died there since 1998, and while the official war ended 5 years ago, the International Resource Committee reports that people are dying of disease and starvation and violence in Congo at the same rate today as during the war, as many as 45,000 every month. That brings journalist and Texas native Brian Mueller to a different kind of battle. Mueller is fighting to make the world aware of the humanitarian crisis in Congo and of the real lives shattered by ongoing violence and unnecessary poverty. Mueller worked in Congo as a staff correspondent for the Associated Press and has written about it for Esquire and Harper's magazines. His new book is called All Things Must Fight to Live, Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. Brian, welcome to Think.
Good to be here. Thanks.
You describe the current conflict as orchestrated entirely by foreign entities. Who's wrapped up in the fighting?
Well, the fighting started really in 1996, 2 years after Rwandan genocide, after about 10,000 of the Hutu rebels, genocidaires, who committed, orchestrated the killing in Rwanda, fled across the border into Congo and hid in the mountains there. And so Rwanda at that time, appealed to Mobutu, the dictator of Congo at that time, and asked him to, you know, rid these guys, rid the country of these Hutu killers. Mobutu refused, and Rwanda invaded in '96 along with Uganda, and under the auspices of, you know, taking these guys out. But they marched 7 months across the jungle and overthrew Mobutu and installed their own leader, Laurent Kabila. When he kind of ostracized his Rwandan lieutenants, Rwanda invaded again, and that sucked in about 7 different African armies at its peak, and a lot of those financed their stay by minerals that are in the country, because Congo is a very wealthy nation full of cobalt, copper, coltan, which is a mineral used to make chips and laptops, and so all of us have a little coltan, in our daily lives. So,
yeah, so Congo, by rights, should not be a poor place.
It should not be a poor place, and at one time, you know, during the 50s and 40s, when Belgians ruled Congo, it was a very wealthy place. Belgium made their empire out of Congo's rubber at the expense of about 10 million people. And, Congo's minerals funded both world wars, the Allied efforts in both world wars, in terms of copper and cobalt and diamonds and tin and aluminum. And it even provided Congo has been used to create the developing world for almost a century. So,
Congo broke from Belgian rule, colonial rule, in 1960. Is that right?
Yeah.
How was there ever a period where its independence was sort of going well?
Not really, because about I think it's 4 days, 5 days after independence, kind of all hell broke loose in Congo. And you know, it's just such a large country. And what happened was, when the Belgians left there in 1960, there was, you know, under a dozen college-educated people in the country. They really repressed the Congolese so much that there was just no blueprint. They left no blueprint. They left no infrastructure for these people to, create a democracy on their own. And I think, in a way, the Belgians were sort of just banking on them to screw it up and they would come back. But that didn't work. The country just completely fell apart after that. Mobutu took over Congo officially in 1965, 5 years after the independence, and he ruled until, the Rwandans invaded, as I said, in 1996, and overthrew him in 1997.
So when you took your first trip into Congo, this is such an interesting story. You were hardly a seasoned war correspondent. You were handed a plane ticket by a friend who was an editor and sort of shoved out the door.
I would work at Esquire for a few years, and I wanted to do something else. I wanted to get out, and it was 2003, and so we were at war in Afghanistan. It was an ever changing world, and I wanted to be part of it. And I felt I couldn't do that really from a desk in Manhattan. And so yeah, I moved to Nairobi, and with my a woman I'd been dating about a few months, and I made friends with the Associated Press bureau chief there in Nairobi. And one day I came in, she was nice enough to let me use the email and the phones in her office. And, I was working on some other stories as freelance and hanging out with cops in Nairobi, like touring the slums and, chasing carjackers and stuff. And nobody's really interested in that story back in the States, and, editors.
And at that point, you felt like Nairobi was the most dangerous place you'd ever been.
Nairobi was the most dangerous place I'd ever been. And the crime there is outrageous. I was hanging out with the police as just sort of this instinctual reaction to my own fear, like maybe I'd be safe with them or something. So one day after one of my patrols, you know, I'd go on these all-night patrols with these undercover cops in the slums and stuff. One morning I walked in and Susan, the editor, told me about a massacre that had happened in Congo where about as many as 1,000 people had been butchered in about 3 hours. She was going to send a couple of her staffers there to cover it, and before I knew it, she handed me a plane ticket and said, you know, I think it'll be a good experience for you. Why don't you go with them? I think maybe you'll sell the story somewhere. And that night I was in Uganda waiting on a cargo flight into Congo the next morning.
And in hiring your first fixer, who is if people don't know, it's a translator who sort of helps you navigate the area, it didn't even occur to you to try and figure out which side he might have been on.
Yeah, I covered that massacre in April, and I came back. I sold that story to the Chicago Tribune. It was my first big sale. You know, I was real happy about it. And then I convinced an editor back in the States to send me back, and I was going to chronicle this massacre because, I think as Americans, we don't really kind of comprehend how that can take place. You know, this is 1,000 people being killed in really short order with mostly machetes and kind of small arms. So I went back to Bunia, which was the capital of the Ituri district where I was going to base myself, and where the Ugandan army was pulling all their troops out slowly out of Congo. So I was there, and in order to help me get my interviews and stuff, I just was at the airport, and I started walking around the airport saying, anybody know where I can, you know, find an interpreter that speaks English? And, you know, of course, French is the official language in Congo, and I had no idea of the tribal affiliations. At that time, there was a massive tribal fight going on between two tribes, the Hema and the Lindu, and they were both waiting for the Ugandans to pull out, and they were going to sack the town when that happened. And so, you know, I was so naive, and I was real green. But luckily, it didn't really backfire on me. And a wonderful guy, Johnny Ngure, showed up at my hotel the next morning, and not only saved my life a couple times over the next few weeks, but also became a really good friend, and is still today. So.
And ironically, you learned from him that his father had been a journalist. He was shot in the back during the fighting.
Yeah, the Bunia. His father, you know, his life is a metaphor, I think, of that whole country. You know, Johnny grew up and he belonged to the Alur tribe. And at that time, the Hema and the Lindu were battling each other, at first over land rights. But then, you know, when the Ugandans came into the war in 98 in that area, they started arming both of these rebel groups and giving them, you know, RPGs and machine guns and really using them as proxy forces to hold control over the gold fields in that area, because northern Congo is just full of gold mines. Soon those two tribes turned on each other even more, and the death count spiked. Johnny's father was caught up in a raid that one of those militias conducted on the town of Bunia, and he was shot, and Johnny had to hide in the bush and buried his dad with his own hands and by himself. And his mom had died years before, so he was left with no one, really.
And these conflicts, there's a point where you talk about, you know, when you're in a bar or somewhere, you have to refer to them as the H or the L, so that people don't know what you're talking about if they don't speak English. Is it sort of like a Hatfield and a McCoy thing?
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, it was just, like I said, back in the late 90s, when the Mobutu Empire was crumbling, there was the Hema are really closely related to the Tutsi of Rwanda. You know, white men drew these borders years ago, and so these are all kind of interconnected tribes. The Tutsi and the Hema are with the landowning class, they're the educated elite. The Belgians always favored them during colonialism, and Mobutu also gave them favor and gave them jobs during his reign. And the Lindu, on the other hand, are associated with the Hutu, and they're more the farmers and the agriculturalists. And what happened was, back in the late 90s, as Mobutu's empire was falling apart, some Hema businessmen just seized a bunch of land in that area of called Inaturi, and there was no documents to prove otherwise. And so, as retaliation, the Hema militia just retaliated as kind of the vigilante forces, and it just started this tit-for-tat. Uganda came in, you know, a year later and just really started salting those wounds and taking advantage of that rift.
You managed to escape from Bunia just a few hours, right, before 500 people were massacred there?
Yeah, I'll address your earlier question. When I got there in Bunia to cover that massacre again, it became very clear that as soon as these Ugandans were going to pull out, which was going to happen in 2 weeks, that these two tribes were going to sack the town, and they were already collecting on the edges of town. And every day I would wake up, and you know, there'd be dead people that greeted us every morning. These taxi drivers who were hacked with machetes, and people hanging from trees. And they were just sending a message, and at the same time, they were hitting this Ugandan army every day as well. And as I said, when you said the H and the L, the paranoia ruled everything, and there was a small UN force there, and they were trying to kind of contain this creeping war that was going to happen. But, they were no match for all these militia forces. They were only going to put in 300 peacekeepers to replace 7,000 Ugandan troops. And so these UN officers became very, very paranoid along with everyone else. Basically, it was a slow siege, and it was a town in a sentence of death, and we knew pretty much the time and the hour when it was going to happen. Sure enough, the Ugandans pulled out on May 6th, and I was able to beg a flight on the general's plane 2 hours. And we took off, and it was the last Ugandan plane out. And as I looked down, as we circled over Bunia, I saw these Lindu warriors kind of marching into town, looked like a line of ants, kind of going in. And that afternoon, the town fell. Over the next 10 days, about 500-600 people were butchered in the streets.
And then, so you went back after the most intense violence had ceased.
Yeah, I was able to escape, and I'm really glad I did. And of course, I left Johnny there at the airport. Johnny gave me a ride to the airport on his motorcycle. It was one of those situations that reporters find themselves in a lot. They befriend these fixers and translators that they leave and these guys have to stay. And these guys are the ones who really face the danger all the time. I said goodbye to Johnny, and I didn't know if I was ever going to see him again. For 10 days, I was back in Nairobi in my apartment. And I tried to get in touch with people on the phone, because there was only cell phones. There's no landlines or anything. And I would call people, and I'd hear kind of gunshots in the background. I never could get in touch with Johnny. So the very first opportunity I had, there was some American missionaries going back about 10 days later, and they were going to pull out some church members in Bunia, and they were going to leave the engine running. They weren't going to stop. They were just going to touch down, pick these people up, and get out of there. So me and a few other reporters, we managed to kind of get on one of their flights, and they left us there, and it was the whole town was completely destroyed, and there were at the time there were bodies a lot in the streets. Hadn't been recovered. It was a really grisly scene.
I want to go back for a minute to the question of UN peacekeepers, because you made it clear that they were outnumbered, but they also were really not allowed to take part in anything to the extent that they would protect people. Is that right?
Yeah, after the Rwandan genocide, when the UN completely dropped the ball on that one and allowed, maybe a million people to be killed, you'd think we'd learned the lesson. That we always say never again, but yet it happened. In 2003, the UN, they have several mandates that they have, and Chapter 7 is a mandate that allows them to protect civilians to use their weapons and actively, secure the population. They didn't have that in Bunia because basically, it wasn't needed for the other part of the country, but because the war was over in the rest of the Congo. But at this time, they needed it and they didn't have it, and so when the town was sacked, these guys just basically watched it all happen.
Brian Mueller is my guest. His new book is called All Things Must Fight to Live, Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is journalist Brian Mueller. His new book is called All Things Must Fight to Live, Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Brian, at the beginning part of this year, the International Resource Committee put out a survey that found that the death rate really hasn't changed since 2003. There are 1,250 people dying a day from things that are related to the fighting. Can you talk about why that is?
Well, the fighting is still going on. And, you know, when we talk about Congo deaths, it's not these kind of sexed up homicides that we, you know, brutality that you know, you think about in other wars, you know, combat deaths. You know, these people, you know, they live in you know, a country that's three times the size of Texas. It's massive and it's full of jungles and you know, in savannas, there's no roads, there's nothing like that, and it's full of disease. You know, it's the second largest rainforest in the world, and so, you know, when there's any kind of fighting at all happening, you know, entire villages flee into these jungles, and they're really susceptible to, you know, starvation, to diarrhea. You know, there's no clean water, so they drink dirty water, and they just start dropping by the dozens. And if they're lucky, then they can find a camp where, you know, like MSF or Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, are there and can help them. But most of these people just die in obscurity. They die, you know, alone and really slowly and painfully. And it's nothing. You know, that's why I think the Congo conflict isn't really known so much, because it's not like a Darfur where, you know, you kind of know where these concentrated killings are happening, and it's like an act of genocide. These people are just dying, you know, alone, and, you know, you walk in Congo and there's bones everywhere in a lot of these places, and that will maybe never be found. You know, it's people just dying of disease, and it's not a sexy kind of way to die. And so otherwise, I think we don't really know about it, so.
Yeah, you have an extraordinary story in the book of coming upon a refugee camp, and there in the camp is a mother with a toddler, essentially, who's dying of diarrhea. And you look at this, and you sort of don't know what to do, and then it occurs to you that you have with you the tools to save this child's life.
Yeah, that was in one of these camps that we were at, and you know, it was one of those situations where you just sort of come upon this little circle of hell, and you know, some aid groups hadn't been at this camp in months, and these people were dying of cholera, they were dying of starvation, and there's no clean water. And this kid, you know, I walk in there, and basically the chief of the village says, you know, we've had three kids die today, do you want to see them? And you're like, yeah, I guess. You know, so you go and you see these dead kids, and, you know, what do? You're staying in a dead kid, and the mother's, you know, holds the kid up for you to take a picture, and so I see a few of these, and, you know, this had happened to me all day that day, because I'd gone to another camp, and I'd seen, you know, the chief of that village said, you know, we have a few kids who died today, you want to see them? So this is like my third or fourth, you know, dead kid that I'd seen that day, and this kid, and I found this, right before I was about to leave, the mother said, you know, my son is really sick, you know, can you look at him? And he was just shivering of fever and diarrhea, and I was like, you know, I was just sitting there writing notes in my notebook, and I just stopped because I just felt so stupid. And I thought, you know, I have a medical kit out in my bag. You know, I've got rehydration salts. I've got ibuprofen for fever. I've got four or five, like, big bottles of clean water. So I went out, and I just unloaded everything I could on these people. And, you know, it's not going to save every kid, but, you know, luckily, you know, I came back the next day, and that kid was still alive. But I think his grandma had dysentery and wasn't expected to live. But, you know, it's so easy, you know, to save these people, but, you know, we just can't catch up to that kind of the avalanche of misery that's kind of oversweeping them, you know.
Yeah, it's got to be hard to be in those situations where you're there really to cover things, but you can't fully separate yourself from what's going on. Can you be an impartial observer?
I think you can. I found it very difficult. You know, when Bunia fell in 2003 and I was there, and there's all, you know, the whole population was huddled up in these camps around the UN compound where they'd finally broken the gates because the UN had locked them out. And so you had about 10,000 people in these camps, and they were dying as well. Luckily, there were some aid groups in there. And, but, you know, like, there's bodies everywhere, there's bodies of kids everywhere. And, you know, and a lot of them had been killed in really horrible ways. And you have to turn yourself off. You have to. There's has to have some kind of mental switch in your head that you flick and you know, you just write notes. You know, and I've heard a lot of my photographer colleagues say that, you know, their camera is the kind of the filter between them, you know, them and what's happening on the other side of it. But after a while, you know, it's really hard, and that's why I felt so stupid. I just stopped there. I'm like, God, you know, I'm a human, and that's a human being, and I can actually save this person, and why wouldn't I do that? You know, I have this higher sort of duty to do that. You know, that's why I'm writing these stories, I think, because not a lot of people are, and I want to help these people. So, yeah, I mean, I'm going to be fine. I'm healthy. You know, I can be rushed out of there immediately if I want to, but these people always stay, I think I can afford some rehydration salts. You know?
One of the ways that you cope with the stress, you and a lot of your journalist friends, you did stuff that you've said you wouldn't have done back home in the U.S. or for your European friends there. Can you talk about Fight Club Kinshasa?
Yeah, Fight Club. That was crazy. I just had a lot of friends in Kinshasa during 2005 when I was the correspondent there. And these guys worked for the UN, and they worked for aid groups, and there are a few journalists there. And we're all a pretty tight group, and we all get together. And we had some Congolese friends there as well. And at that time, there was a lot of paranoia in Kinshasa because it was supposed to be the election on June 30th. And obviously, because of a lot of foot dragging by the government. They weren't going to hold elections, so the opposition party had planned a big demonstration. There was a lot of rumors going around that there was going to be a massive, what they call the pillage, like this big pillage and rioting throughout the city where, you know, the population would turn against all the kind of the expats and all the owning class, and they would, like they had done, you know, there had been a couple of those in the early 90s where the army had rioted and just gone looting through the diplomatic quarters and basically stripped Kinshasa of everything, and the country is still, I mean, the city is still kind of reeling from that one pillage in 91, and there was another one in 97, so after all these different pillages, there's just nothing left, and so, obviously, you know, the big fear is, like, you know, these soldiers go in, and they're going to rape white women and all this kind of stuff, and that's, it really has an effect on everyone, and so, as these days began, we counted down to June 30th. Paranoia was really high, and all these groups started getting out, and the UN were, you know, evacuating their people, and a lot of us just started, one day, I guess that's how we dealt with the stress. One of my friends said, you know, I got all these boxing gloves and some headgear. I got them in the mail. You know, let's just, you know, we're going to start doing it for exercise. Let's just start, you know, kickboxing or something. And so we started doing that in the backyard of my friend Andy's house. And it turned into something more kind of dark after a while. And we'd all get together and we'd just kind of fight each other until we sort of fell down and collapsed. And it was these two-minute fights, but it became some weird, some strange, dark sort of event for the paranoia and the frustration. And even though we were friends, we just sometimes lose our heads in it. I'm not a violent person. I would never do that in the States, but... for some reason, it just kind of made sense at that time.
Journalist Brian Mueller is my guest. His new book is called All Things Must Fight to Live, Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Alex in Dallas. Hi, Alex.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And forgive me if this is something that you talked about before. Mobutu was said to have stolen billions of dollars during his rule and put it to Swiss banks. Did Congo ever get that money back?
Did Congo ever get Mobutu's money back? No. No, they haven't. Laurent Kabila, when he came in, made some big vow that he was going to, you know, he'd find all Mobutu's Swiss bank accounts and stuff. And he got the support of the United States and the European Union and all these kind of people, or the World Bank. I think there's still millions left from Mobutu's accounts. You know, they went to make palaces in the jungle. You know, Mobutu has this huge palace north of Kinshasa in the jungle where you can land a Concorde jet on it. You know, so that money's gone. You know, the Congolese will never see that money again.
An email from GK asks, why do the conflicts in Africa, particularly in Congo and Darfur, receive so little coverage in the U.S. media? If we base our coverage on the number of victims, African conflicts should eclipse the Arab-Israeli or Bosnian conflicts, yet we barely pay attention to them.
Yeah, that goes back to what I said. We have no interest in it. Why should we do anything? We didn't stop the Rwandan genocide. We had no, we have no oil there. I mean, this is my opinion. It's hard to get Americans to, even think about our own war right now, much less one that's happening in Congo in a place that a lot of people have never heard of or, could really pronounce, these kind of names. And like I said before, these people are dying and not, they're not combat deaths. They're people dying of sickness. And that sort of gets swept under the rug even more easily.
You came home to the States periodically during this time that you were reporting in Congo, and it had to have been incredibly frustrating to run into old friends, and you would meet people who said, Congo, wasn't that a movie? They had no idea.
Yeah. I didn't expect it as much. My friends, I was living in New York at the time, and my friends, they know about Congo just as much as I've told them, and I think they're probably more educated than most people. But yeah, you go to a party and people say like, well, I heard you were in Congo. What was that like? And I wanted to tell them. And I just started telling people what it was like. And I told them every detail about it. And I think more in an effort to make sense of it myself. And when it was done, I think I let these people just kind of I think they got more than they bargained for. But I'll tell anybody about Congo. I'll talk about it anytime if anybody wants to hear about it. I think it's a completely underreported thing, and I think everybody should know. Just as human beings who don't want to see other human beings suffer, I think we have a duty just to know about it, just to read about it and tell others if we can.
What sort of, you mentioned that they were international aid workers. What sort of aid presence is in Congo right now?
There's a lot of aid. The UN has its biggest peacekeeping mission in Congo. There's 18,000 peacekeepers now. They learned the lesson, I think, after the fall of Bunia, that they had to go in and protect people. So, they've increased their mandate. And they're protecting the population, and they're fighting these militia, on a weekly, monthly basis now. There's groups like UNICEF that are there, and there are groups like Doctors Without Borders is by far above and beyond one of the greatest groups that are working in Congo. They're always the first ones there. Kind of blood up to their elbows and never asking thanks and saving these kids who are dying in the bush when the government really can't be bothered to do it. And my hat's off to those guys. A lot of the UN. And there's a lot of NGOs working in Congo. I don't know how much good they do. I don't know how much good my stories do.
Well, you write, food aid fills stomachs, but it doesn't create economies.
Yeah. Yeah, what are the answers to that? I don't really know. I also said in that same paragraph, I think that there are hundreds of answers to Congo's a few questions, and I think everybody has very good intentions, but just like me, just like reporters, and nobody's there for more than a couple of years. They rotate in and out, and for the rest of their lives, they'll say, yeah, I was in Congo that time. It was it's pretty wild, but I think it's going to happen. I think people are slowly sort of getting results from these aid groups. But then again, it's like the country is so large. It's a Band-Aid situation, and I don't really have the answer for it exactly.
There's been a lot of Chinese investment in Congo, hasn't there, recently?
I'm sorry?
There's been a lot of Chinese investment.
Oh yeah, the Chinese have come in, and they're getting a lot of criticism, saying they're the new colonialist or whatever. China's been in Africa for a long, long time, and I think has helped Africa a lot when a lot of countries don't. The Chinese see their involvement in Africa as strictly business. Yes, they've pumped a lot of weapons into Africa and in Congo as well, and that's does what weapons do, destabilizes the population and fuels armed groups. But in Congo recently, they signed this $9 billion deal, where the government would just sort of sit aside a bunch of minerals, and in exchange for these minerals, they're going to completely revamp the entire infrastructure of that country. So what you're going to have is China coming in and building 2,000 miles of roads, basically, you know, barreling through the jungle. These roads, 2,000 miles of railroad, that, you know, building railroad that didn't even exist before, building dozens of hospitals, dozens of universities, hundreds of housing units for government employees. I mean, you know, Mobutu and the Belgians and Kabila, they couldn't have imagined doing that in 50, 60 years, and the Chinese are going to do it in three. And, you know, they're already taking the minerals anyway, so let's see what happens when, you know, they can give something back.
When you move through the country, you carry with you this 1951 Belgian colonial era sort of tourist guide. After a while, that had to be just an exercise in comparing how much things had changed, right?
Yeah, it's another country in that book. You know, as a writer, you have to sort of catch yourself from using, like, well, now, here's like, it once was this, and now it is this. And basically, you know, the Belgians back in the 50s, and, you know, throughout the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they built Congo. Congo was one of the most advanced and developed colonies in all of Africa. You know, the best hospitals were in Belgian Congo. The best roads were in Belgian Congo. You could actually, you know, they used to market Belgian Congo as sort of this adventure for, outdoorsmen. You could go fishing in the river and in the Congo River, and you go hunting in the east, and there's big game lodges, and you know, in the cities there were, you know, European style boulevards where you could go to French restaurants and you know, have nice wine and champagne. And of course, all that's gone now. You still have sort of that, some of that in Lubumbashi and Kinshasa, but you know, the jungle has sort of taken over everything, and these people have no infrastructure whatsoever, and that in turn strangle these economies. You know, these people can't move their goods from one market to the next, and one day maybe that'll come back. But it is like looking at a cartoon or something in that book.
Journalist Brian Mueller is my guest. His new book is called All Things Must Fight to Live: Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. After the break, we'll talk a little bit about what happened when Brian went back looking for signs of renewal in Congo. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Texas-born journalist Brian Mueller, whose new book is called All Things Must Fight to Live: Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Brian, at one point you decide that you want to go back and sort of travel through this country and to get around, because there isn't any sophisticated infrastructure. You're taking ferry or tugboats and bicycles and broken down trains. Can you talk about what you were looking for?
Yeah. You know, I came to cover the election in July 2006, and it finally happened. And I went back to the east where I'd covered all that fighting the years before. And I was really hopeful about this election. If the election went off peaceful, then it would signify a lot, you know, that the country had kind of turned a page. And sure enough, you know, it was wonderful. Like, the election happened, there wasn't any violence. These people were allowed to vote in peace. There had been a lot of threats of militia attacking the polls, and that never happened. And so I left Eastern Congo feeling, you know, really buoyant and just, you know, ambulance, you know, I was really hopeful, and I went back to Kinshasa just to have some, you know, a couple beers with my buddies and just hang out. And before I went back to the States, and while I was there, there was fighting broke out in Kinshasa between the president, Kabila's men, and the guy he ran against in the election. This guy Jean-Pierre Bemba. You know, the election turned out to be a draw, and they were going to do a runoff. But you know, one of these two guys, forces, started shooting the other ones, and it sparked a 3-day massive battle in the capital, in the streets, and I was stuck in this hotel, and as tanks were shooting down the streets below, and my friend's wife was stranded on the other side of town, right on the front lines, and we didn't know if she was going to make it or not. For the past 3 years, I'd really gone looking for war, and I wanted to find a war, and I certainly found it. And now, as my friend's trying to call his wife, and she's just terrified, while these gunshots and tanks are firing right below her apartment.
Yes, wait, I'm sorry for interrupting. He's on the phone with her, and he's hearing the gunshots that she's hearing right outside.
Yeah. You can hear him in the phone, across the room. His face is just, white as a sheet. And I was like, this is what I came here for. This is the war I wanted to find, right? Well, it's kind of found me, it was kind of all of ours at that moment. And I decided that time, at that moment, that I never really wanted to see that kind of fighting there again. And that my legacy in Congo would just be these battlefields and massacre sites and displaced camps that I'd really sought out. And the war had ended, in the country, 3 or 4 years before. And I had some idea in my head that, in the middle of the jungle, the war had ended and, it was just, all, just fields of flowers or something and people, happy and living their life. And I had had these naive ideas that I was going to find some kind of revival. So a few months later, I came back and I did the Joseph Conrad Heart of Darkness journey up the Congo River on a barge, and it was one of the most difficult things I'd ever experienced. And we had about 500 people on these big flat, there's like three steel barges tied together, pushed by a tugboat, and these people are all traders, so they're trading with the jungle people, the villagers who live in the jungles. Paddle out and they trade, bush meat for some medicines and use clothing and stuff because, this is the only kind of supermarket coming that way and it doesn't come very often, maybe once a month or something. And so while it was really wonderful to see how, the informal economy has moved, in Congo where there are no roads because, that river is the only way to get across that country unless you want to buy a plane ticket. Those are like hundreds of dollars and most people can't afford that. So that was nice. But what happened was, I started noticing that everybody in the interior in these jungles were kind of in worse off condition than in these war zones, and it was worse because they had been forgotten, and a lot of them, these kids had these bowling ball bellies, that telltale sign of malnutrition, and their hair was kind of copper colored, and worse, we got up after a month, we were stranded up on the river, and there was no more boats taking us to our destination, Kisangani, which is about 300 or 400 miles away, and so we just made this decision that we would take bicycles through the jungle, and we'd hire a caravan of bikers to take us to the jungle, and the conditions were even worse inside the jungle, and those bikes were just these steel cargo bikes, and they were in terrible condition, and we ended up going through swamps and mud up to our ankles and our knees, and crossing these ancient rivers and these bridges that had been washed out, and what happened was we ran out of food about the third day on the journey, and had to kind of beg for food from these starving villagers. And by the end of it, all of us were real sick. I was kind of coming down. I thought I was coming down with malaria. We were just so weak because we couldn't sleep at night because we were so hungry and there was just bugs. And by the time I got out of there after 8 days on those bikes, it had been like 5 week journey. And I felt I came out just completely empty-handed. I was really frustrated. For the rest, I went home just feeling really down and frustrated that, I had some kind of half-cocked notion of what progress was, and it was just some sort of manufactured idea of what was going to happen. It was like my Western mind sort of thinking like, oh, there's always a bright side, right? And in fact, there wasn't a bright side, and these people were just kind of starving and forgotten, and so. And that's, I tell that story in chapter 4 of my book, but I didn't come out what I was, I didn't get what I was looking for.
So. You do write, though, at the end of the book that you're, it sounds as if you're able to at least sort of close the book,
Yeah, well, I came back, after spending the winter, feeling pretty frustrated, depressed, and kind of empty-handed, I thought, I heard that there was, those Belgian railroads were up and running again, and I'd always wanted to take those trains. And basically, the train infrastructure is mostly in the southern part of the country in this province called Katanga, And that's the big copper belt of Africa. And that's basically, you know, Katanga is what, it's the gold mine of, you know, it's like the jewel trough of the Belgian Empire, you know. All the copper and cobalt from that area were used to fund the whole country, and Mobutu stole billions of those dollars. And so, you know, this guy was going to ride the old rails that the Belgians used to pump out all this copper and cobalt. And, you know, they were built in, like, the late 1800s, early 1900s. And I was able to find the first and the only luxury train rolling in Congo. There, you know, the government had managed to, you know, roll this train called the Renove, you know, from Lubumbashi in the south to Kalimi, which is on Lake Tanganyika in the east. And I was really wanting to go on this train. So I went down and I got a ticket. And at the time, you know, I was hearing stories that, you know, the UNHCR, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, were repatriating a lot of people from the war. These people were finally coming home after being stranded for 10 or 15 years, for 10 years since the war had broken out. And I realized that my train journey would kind of intersect with these people coming back over from Zambia and from Tanzania, you know, where they'd fled after the war. So I was hoping that when I got to Kalimi after on this train ride, that I would find these people coming over from these other countries and maybe follow them home. So I was holding out for this hopeful ending to my book. But when I got on this train and we started rolling up through the savannah and stuff, I started, you know, as I do, I'm a reporter, so I go and I started meeting everybody aboard and talking to them and hearing their stories. And what I realized was the homeward bound, and in fact found me, that every one of these people were coming home. And so what, you know, everybody I met were going home to find their jobs again, to reclaim their homes again, to see their children who they hadn't seen in 10 years. You know, these people had fled, and, you know, maybe the grandfather took the kids and fled one way, and the mother and father fled one way, you know, and they just got separated. And a lot of people, you know, they didn't know if their kids were even alive. And so, you know, it was this real, all this anticipation on this train journey going down, and it took us, you know, we derailed twice, and by the end of the train journey, the luxury train, it was full of chickens and pigs and some of these, you know, clandestines, these people who jumped the roof and stuff, but, you know, in the end, it took all these people home, and when we finally arrived at Kalimi Station, you know, there were just hundreds of people waiting on the platform, just with their arms open, and it was like this massive reunion, and it just almost dropped me to my knees. It was one of the greatest things I'd ever seen, and I knew at that moment that I could leave Congo, that I'd seen it, like it'd come full circle. You know, I came to Congo in blood and misery and flight, you know, all these people leaving their homes and you know, fleeing war, and I ended with people coming home from the war, and it was a good circle, and it ended it, and I was very thankful and fortunate that I was able to find that train.
Are you afraid to go back because the train won't be there?
I'd love to go back to Congo. I don't want to go back anytime soon. I think I'm done for a while. You know, I'm working on another book right now in Malawi about this kid who builds windmills out of tractor parts and old blue gum trees and stuff, and powers his village with you know, out of nothing. And it's sort of like the direct remedy from Congo. And I want to go back to Congo when I think it's going to get better. You know, once the government starts regulating these minerals and cleans up the armed groups in the east. You know, it's a beautiful country. It's one of the most stunning landscapes I've ever seen in my life. And you know, there's gorillas, and, you know, you can go on gorilla tours, like, you know, apes and stuff. And so there's tourism, you know. And I'd like to go back as a tourist. I'd like to, you know, spend money there as a tourist. But I don't want to go anytime soon. I know what's happening there right now. You know, it's not much better than when I left.
Brian Mueller is my guest. His book is called All Things Must Fight to Live, Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. Let's speak to Wendy in San Antonio. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, how you doing, Brian?
Oh, good.
Hey, I missed your book signing in San Antonio yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, I'm glad you got me now.
Yes, I did. I was going to do it any way I knew how. I am about halfway through your book, and I read all your articles in Harper's and Esquire, and I just wanted to thank you for bringing such detail to us about this country.
Well, hey, thanks. I'm glad I got an audience.
Well, Your audience is bigger than you know. Keep writing. Keep writing, and we got your back on this end.
All right. Thanks so much.
Take care.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Faye Mae in Fort Worth. Hi, Faye Mae.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay. I'm actually from Congo. That's a really good show. I'm going to have one comment and one question to the guest. So my comment is Congo is not like an open market. So what happened is, so far we're expecting the government to provide the basic. They guess no harm rich is the country. So the problem is because the government doesn't do anything. All the money are just taking away, or they just use it for themselves. So the question is going to be for him, the guest. Is ever have chance to interview the government of the Congo, make them understand this country is rich. How come we live on the poor like that? Where all the mineral goes, where all the wealth of the country goes. I mean, ever a chance to ask them what happened to all the gold, the diamond of the country, where does the money goes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and a question that all Congolese should be asking. And, I've interviewed a lot of government people, and they say, oh, you know, we're working on it now, we're working on it, we're going to, you know, we have sweeping reforms, and these reforms are going to happen. You know, everybody uses Mobutu as the example, you know, as a scapegoat. You know, Mobutu stole all these millions of dollars, but they're going to be better than Mobutu. And so far they haven't been. What happened, and I think a lot of Congolese don't know this, is that during the war, the government sold all these mining contracts to anybody who really wanted them. And, you know, because there were 7 African armies in there, you know, the government of Kabila really needed help to fight Uganda and Rwanda. So, he appealed to Namibia and Zimbabwe and these 2 countries in particular, and really paid them to help him in mining contracts and logging concessions. And, you know, those countries are still getting those minerals. And, you know, right now you have the Chinese in, and for the past, you know, 10 years or so, you know, all these minerals are leaving in the dead of night. They're leaving in the back of these rail cars, in the back of the trucks over the border, and people are so poor. You know, these cops and these immigration officials and these customs officials, they're so poor. They haven't been paid in years. You know, and so, you know, what stops them from taking a little bribe from some Congolese middleman who's selling to, you know these Chinese dealers and stuff? You know, it's graft, and everybody's in for himself. And once that's regulated, and once there's some kind of, I don't know, pressure on the government, it's going to keep happening, and the Congolese will never, reap the benefits of their own minerals.
Brian Mueller's new book is called All Things Must Fight to Live: Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.